you know, I've never been there before, and I'm not sure I'd be comfortable in it.
Your time will be coming.
Yes, are we recording? Good morning, everyone. I'm Randy Christman, Chairman of the Public Service Commission. It is Wednesday, January 18th at 10 o'clock. We're gathered for a regular scheduled meeting of the North Dakota Public Service Commission. I call the meeting to order. For opening comments, I will say that I think most are aware that one of the big reductions efforts that this commission is making on our budget had to do with grain elevator licensing, and at one point or another, we were all in Fargo at the grain dealers convention here starting on Sunday that ended yesterday morning. Actually, I was down there Sunday night and Monday, had a lot of good conversations. When there are rules and laws that are decades and probably in some cases over a century old, sometimes change is kind of not accepted very readily. But I think we're making progress. And I have to say, I did find out a few flaws that need to be corrected in our proposal, and so I found it very useful and appreciate all the feedback that we've gotten both from grain dealers as well as egg producers around the state. And so that's I think coming along. Other than that, everything with the budget everybody knows already, so that's all the opening comments that I have today. Is there an order to this?
Yeah, you go to this and then back to there. Because I had to sit there for 3 years and listen to Julie talk first.
Well, I know I'm first, but beyond that, I just
didn't. And you would take all the good comments. So the person in the third spot really has to be the sharpest in the room.
You're on deck, Major.
Very well.
I think I've been here twice.
Back to the point, right? Fair enough. Let's see here. The only opening comments I would just wanted to pontificate about is the... we got a new president coming on Friday, and in case some of you missed that, it'll be very interesting to see how it all plays out. And the comments that I want to talk about were a little bit about federal energy policy, and I think what we're going to see is, you know, there'll be federal energy policy is like a big ship. It moves very slowly, and over the last 8 years, I think we've seen a movement more towards renewables and gas peakers, and I think we'll see over the next couple of years a stabilization of energy policy. And it'll be very interesting to see 2 years from now where it goes to, if the move to renewables stays that way, if the carbon capture and technology with new coal continue to evolve and companies are willing to invest in next generation coal, we'll see a future for coal. But I think it's everybody that I've been talking to is like, oh, things are going to change overnight on energy policy. And I'm like, no, they're not going to change overnight on energy policy. I've talked with leadership at Xcel, leadership at MDU, and leadership at Otter Tail, and they're committed to the plans they've laid out. And I don't think you'll see any changes in the companies that we regulate overnight. Now, maybe over time you might see some changes, but as much discussion as there's been about how tough the Obama administration has been on coal, which they have been, you know, low-cost natural gas has been as challenging for coal's future as anything. So that's, I guess, I'm very anxious for the new administration to start getting to work. Secretary Perry, hopefully gets sworn in here at some time as the new energy secretary. I see where he's been invited to North Dakota. Secretary Perry's chief of staff is a current commissioner out of Texas. I know Randy and I have met her. Julie probably has too, Brandy Martinez. And so we've got good ties with the secretary, if you will, via, you know what he thinks. And so I think it's a great opportunity for North Dakota to once again look at its energy policy. I'm very excited to see that there's at least going to be a stabilization, I think, of energy policy. But that's my pontification for today, because you tie it back to us. You know, I don't think you're going to see as many wind farms as perhaps we thought we might see, but we're still going to see them. I think we're going to see companies that maybe were looking at retirement of some of their coal to maybe shift that to the right a little bit, to where they'll get some more years of useful life out of it. And if the price of gas stays, I think we'll see some more peakers being built. But right now, energy demand is kind of stabilized. So if industry gets going, maybe we'll see an uptake in that. But a lot of pontification, but I know you expect that from the second speaker to do that.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Just a couple of thoughts to play off of what you were talking about in terms of our budget. And first of all, you've all been told about what our budget changes were, and Randy really worked very hard with staff on coming up with a good proposal for how we can change how we work at the PSC. The area that we're focusing on is our licensing area. And I think it's important to – there's been confusion among the folks that were regulating the grain dealers as well as the commodity groups as to what exactly is this? What does it mean? What are we trying to do? How can we best understand it? And in my opinion, it's fairly simple what we're proposing, but I get that when you look at it in a bill form, it seems very confusing because the bill is 29 pages because it deals with all of the jurisdiction in our grain licensing. So the bill makes it more confusing than what it actually is we're trying to accomplish. And I think really we're updating the approach to overseeing the industry. We're going to be focusing less on measuring the storage in place and the reserves in place and more on how the grain facilities are processing their business and, you know, signing the contracts and initiating those and how they're tracking everything in their books. And so I think we'll be focusing more on that. And then the second piece is the creation of this grain insolvency fund, indemnity fund. And that really will apply to everybody, not just the credit sale contract. So there's those two components. One is on the regulatory side. The other is creating a fund through the levies of some fees on the percent of sales. And it's going to create a fund that, if there is an insolvency, provides more coverage to the folks who are impacted by the insolvency so that they will ultimately, we believe, lose less money and be kept more whole. So it's really an investment in a self-funded insurance plan by the producers out there. So really, I think it's a great proposal. We've had some good conversations with the groups impacted by it and some positive feedback and some questions that have led to some changes that make it better. And I really hope that ultimately the industry groups impacted get behind this and support it and help us take this new approach to this regulation that we're responsible for providing. So that's all I wanted to talk about this morning. Thanks, Randy.
And by the way, the hearing on that bill, it's House Bill 1126, is Friday morning. Okay, we have 8 items on the consent calendar. I move passage of those items.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Okay. regular agenda items. Item RC1, I move the commission close out contract number AM-720-15 with Ross Smith, doing business as Earthworm Excavating, for completion of sinkhole filling and other emergency and maintenance work at abandoned coal mines in western North Dakota.
Second.
On April 8th of 2015, the commission awarded a contract to Ross Smith, as I said, doing business as Earthworm Excavating. He's from Tolna, North Dakota, for a 2-year project to fill dangerous sinkholes caused by the collapse of underground mine workings. Sinkhole filling and other work was conducted at sites near Beulah, Bowman, Dickinson, Glenallen, Haines, New Leipzig, Noonan, Richardson, Scranton, Valva, Williston, Wilton, and Zapp, so practically the whole half of western North Dakota. Work began April 22nd of 2015 and was completed just this past December 3rd. During the project, 345 dangerous sinkholes were filled. Emergency coal refuse fires near Haines and Dickinson were also extinguished, and erosion features were stabilized at the Richter and Beichler AML Valva sites. The contract amount was $200,000, and 2 change orders were issued. The first converted money from sinkhole filling to seeding with no charge to the contract amount. The second added $1,247 for erosion control blankets at the Valva site. The total amount paid to Earthworm under the contract was then $201,246.96. Bill Dodd supervised this project, and the work was completed to his satisfaction. The contractor certified that all the employees and subcontractors and suppliers have been paid. The first invoice was submitted, and it has been paid. And all this work has been done satisfactorily, and the AML division recommends the contract be closed.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Great job, Bill and team. Having several hundred more of these filled is a great accomplishment. RC2, I move the commission approve the Wilton Phase 3, Columbus Phase 16 of 2017 exploratory drilling and, excuse me, 2017 sinkhole filling projects for abandoned mine reclamation in 2017 and submit the 2017 to 2020 North Dakota Abandoned Mine Land Simplified Grant Application to the Office of Surface Mining to request $2,793,000 in federal funds.
Second.
Well, first of all, with all the numbers and dates mixed together in that motion, it's hard to imagine that the word simplified ultimately works its way into it, but it did. last week, we received notice that the OSM allocated the state of North Dakota $2,793,000 for the next AML grant, which begins in March 1st of this year. We should have been allocated $3 million as a minimum program state, but the program is reduced by 6.9% due to sequestration. The AML division plans for 2017 include four major parts. The Wilton Phase 3 is a drilling and grouting project, and it'll be a continuation of work that began in 2015 to pump pressurized grout into the underground mine workings. The sites are mainly along public roads and one farmstead southeast of Wilton in Burley County. That project is estimated at $1.5 million. Up in Columbus, we have phase 16 of all this. It's a 43-acre project with elimination of about 4,500 feet of dangerous high walls. This is south of Columbus in Burke County. Most of these high walls are 15 to 25 feet high, and the estimated project cost there is about $450,000. And then we have about $350,000 worth of exploratory drilling that will be used to locate and characterize suspected underground coal mines. And this will be near the cities of Burlington, Foxholm, Noonan, Partial, and Rose Glen. We have also, there'll be money available for sinkhole filling and maintenance and emergencies. $100,000 will be used in 2017 for those situations. So the estimated cost of all the projects is about $2.4 million. With carryover monies from last year's grant and the construction funds that we'll be receiving, we expect to have more than $3 million in construction funds available for this year's projects, and about $1 million of the grant total amount will be needed for staff salaries, travel, and other operating expenses. And not the staff salaries and expenses, but the construction period on these can go on for 3 years until February 28th of 2020, if necessary.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
I forgot. When do we put these back out for bids again? How does that all play out once this comes back?
About March,
okay. So my comment would be that, you know, there's been a slowdown of oil and gas, but the work that these folks have been doing has been keep going, and we've seen construction prices go up and down. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out, but there's a lot of work for some companies in the region to bid on coming up.
It's always one of my favorite days here to sit in on the bid openings and see the contractors.
The secret bid openings with the Manila envelope.
It seems wonderful to see these contractors coming in and looking for work for their folks for the summer.
Yeah. Is there any further discussion? Since none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
You heard it here. Randy doesn't watch the Oscars, but he watches bid opening.
And if I had to deviate from that schedule, I'd sacrifice and miss the bid openings, but I am not wasting time on the Oscars. I'll guarantee that.
I saw him last year in here with popcorn and soda sitting. just saying.
Is there a red carpet for this event?
Oh. Okay, RC3, I move the commission propose the attached revisions to the North Dakota Administrative Code, issue a notice of intent to amend administrative rules and notice of public hearing, and issue an abbreviated notice of intent to amend administrative rules and notice of public hearing for publication in each official county newspaper throughout the state as required by law, and Public Service Commission, Public Utilities Rulemaking, case number PU-16-775, and Public Service Commission, Public Utilities, Wind Decommissioning Rulemaking, case number PU-17-23. And these would include section administrative rule section 69-06-08-01, energy conversion facility siting criteria, section 69-09-02-35, installation and maintenance conformance to National Electrical Safety Code, and chapter 69-09-09, the wind turbine decommissioning.
Second.
So the first of these, the conversion facility siting criteria and the electrical code are kind of new to me, and I didn't have these for very long. They were attached to this motion, but the bottom line really has to do with if you go to page 7 of it. Well, actually, it starts on page 6.
Five.
There's that adding noise or light-sensitive land uses. Mm-hmm. But then in the policy criteria, I think, is the significant thing, that it adds an additional criteria to the list, and that will be the new number N is in Nancy, a commitment to install aircraft detection and lighting systems for wind energy conversion facilities subject to Federal Aviation Administration approval. This was something that has been built into our orders for the last number of wind farms, an idea that Commissioner Fedorchak brought to our attention during one of the cases, and we think is... Our orders have, I think, shown that there's a commitment from this commission that's the future of wind farm siting, that when that becomes approved by the FAA, that these wind farms need to have these new lighting systems where there's a radar control and that the lights don't need to flash unnecessarily all night and irritate neighbors for many miles around, but can actually be turned on automatically when some kind of aircraft gets nearby. And so I think it's a good improvement. I'll finish the decommissioning part, and maybe there'll be more comment on that. But I do think it is certainly a great thing that we've been adding that to our orders, and now we're looking at adding it as a rule. The wind decommissioning, we had a work session on this already and have taken a lot of feedback and made alterations and really worked on this for months. And so I'm not going to go through the whole thing page by page or we'd be here all day. And I think most people know most of what is in it. Probably I'll just hit on some of the very biggest changes. If you go over on page 3, the decommissioning responsibility. In the past, it's been the operator of a facility. And as those things change, I'm not sure how you would track that. And, of course, once it's been abandoned at some point, there probably really is no operator technically. So this will change it, that the owner is responsible for decommissioning. And then the next section, starting on page 3 and carrying forward, defines abandonment and useful life. on page 4, we talk about that what the decommissioning period really is. We don't want to just have a rule that has to be done, but never any time frame. And so with these rules, they would need to begin decommissioning within 8 months after abandonment or the end of the useful life and complete it within 24 months. Unless, then there's a provision in here, the commission approves a plan for something else. So if something just meets the definition of abandonment or end of useful life, but the owner has realistic plans for doing something different, it's not set in stone that it can't be changed. They would just need to bring it to us and get approval of an alternative plan. Starting on page 5 are the decommissioning requirements. A lot of these aren't a lot different than what they were before, or I don't think real significant, but to me one of the biggest ones, though, is when it comes to removal of buildings and foundations and ancillary equipment. I'm not talking about cables, but the real heavy things. In the past, it's been 3 feet. It will continue to be 3 feet for facilities constructed before July 1st of 2017. But for facilities constructed after that, it would go to 4 feet. On page 6, we get into the decommissioning plan that needs to be filed. And for new facilities, it'll need to be filed prior to the commencement of construction. And over on page 7 is a little change, and one of the examples where someone came in and had a request, and I suggested the staff that we honor it, and the point being that we're going to require that these decommissioning plans be updated every 5 years. Construction costs change, a variety of things will change. But with one company, their concern was that, you know, there's a lot of initial costs up front, a lot of investment. Really, the first 10 years, it would be unlikely that anything would be happening anyway. So their request was to start those five-year intervals after 10 years. And so number 3C down there toward the bottom of page 7 makes that change from what we discussed at the work session. So the first one after the initial one before commencing construction wouldn't be due until their 10th year. On page 8, we address that the existing facilities kind of continue as has been in the past, that they provide their financial assurances after the 10th year of operation instead of before the commencement of construction. Starting in the middle of page 8, it discusses financial assurances and goes on for several pages, but I think the key change is toward the middle or slightly to the bottom of page 9. We get into a section there where similar to what is the case with coal mine reclamation, the commission for the financial assurances may accept a self-guarantee or parent guarantee if a number of things that are laid out, but one of them is a Class A or higher rating from a nationally recognized statistical rating organization. And up till now, while that's a requirement for coal mine reclamation, in the old rules, the requirement on wind decommissioning has been B. And I think it's important they have a strong rating in both instances. When it comes to mining, OSM seems to think it's important that they have an A rating, and so we made that consistent with what the mines are required to do. And that, I think, highlights most of it without going into all the details like we did in our work session.
We have a motion, a second. Is there a further discussion?
I would just thank Randy for putting this together. You kind of spearheaded this. I know Jack spent a lot of time on it. This has been a needed package to go in for at least the whole 8 years that I've been in the commission. I remember the very first work session I had in a wind farm. I was new coming here with a natural resources background, and I asked about what are the decommissioning rules and what's all that, and just as a new guy asking the questions. And basically it was, well, we've kind of been told to kick that can down the road for 10 years and we'll worry about it then. And it always kind of bothered me that there wasn't a set of rules that we should really, you know, formalize on the decommissioning plan, because at some point in time these turbines need to come down. And so I really appreciate my colleagues having this discussion over the last, it's been at least the last year, maybe longer. And one thing about a rules package, just to clarify a little bit, so we do this today, and there's a notice that'll come out later on that we'll have hearings set up, and we'll get groups that'll come in, and they'll testify for or against these rules. And what I think is important in this rules package is that we had some, I think, robust discussion amongst the three of us about what should be in or what shouldn't be in. I think we kind of settled in. We put everything that we may want into the package, and if, as we go forward, some of this peels back out, you don't have to renotice it again. If we want to add something to it, that's a bit of a challenge. So there will be things, I think, that by the time this shakes out, that may come out of this rules package. So this is the beginning of, I think, the discussion with the stakeholders out there. And it'll be very interesting to see what the different groups come in and talk about. I think it'll predominantly be wind developers that come in, companies. When I think about this package, I don't think so much about it being a wind farm owned by XL Energy or MDU or Otter Tail, because we have an ability as a regulated utility to reach out and touch them. And so when it looks at, let's say XL's in the room today, if XL gets to the end of a useful life, I don't worry so much about them decommissioning it, because the monies that they would need to do that are regulated by us. We make sure they put it in their depreciation schedule ahead of time, so they're depreciating out their wind farms, they're putting some money in there that to recoup it. The question is, to reclaim it, the question is it enough money? But what I worry about is the companies that they come in North Dakota, they have big promises about what they're going to do with wind farms. They lease up land from landowners. They go out there and they start a project, and then all of a sudden they don't finish it, and there's holes left in the ground, or they maybe get it built and they don't have a good power purchase agreement that expires, and then they walk away from it and go bankrupt. That, in my mind, is what we're really trying to avoid, and I think it's very, very good discussion. We actually, one of my motions that gets to me is a transfer of certificate from one company to the other. We've seen many wind farms certificates get transferred around because the companies can't actually get them built. And so I think that we've got good companies doing good work, that this shouldn't be a problem for them. If we've got some of the dubious actors out there that never could get this thing fully built and make it pencil out, and they walk away, these are the people that I think, in my mind, that we're really trying to make sure we have the good companies operating. So I appreciate Randy spearheading this, and I know that Julie probably talked more about the lighting, because I know that was your addition. I think that's a good addition, and just look forward to the discussion with industry on this.
I, too, think this is a great package. It's I look forward to additional conversation with the industry on it, because I'm sure they'll have a lot of input. I know it's been triggering a lot of conversations out there. And it also, though, is important to note that while the industry is is concerned, so are the landowners. And so those are conversations that maybe don't always bubble up into more formal circles, but those are the things that we're hearing constantly. I know I am when I'm out and about, from people who maybe don't have as much of a public presence, but they're the people who are out there living in with these facilities and having these facilities and welcoming them into their backyard or their communities. So that's also an important group of people that I hope engage in our public hearing on this issue when we have it. But really, I think this does a couple of key things. Claire, you defined what abandonment means. That's important, so we know what we're talking about when something is or isn't abandoned. This really eliminates some of the fuzzy area of that. It increases the removal for the foundations, which is something that we've heard a lot from the landowners, like, why only 3 feet? This goes down to 4. It's a significant change and improvement for the reclamation purposes. Strengthens the financial requirements and triggers the filing of a decommissioning plan upon construction, not operation. That's a big change. Before, we required it when they construct. Now, when they when they operated, now when they construct, they have to have it right to us. So that's great. And then I appreciate staff throwing in the lighting to this package. It's not something we talked about at our previous work sessions, but since we're dealing with this package, I felt that it was an appropriate time to add that as well, since it is what we're doing on a regular basis in our order. orders, that that should be reflected in our rules. So I look forward to hearing from the companies on that issue as well and getting, I hope, some more technical information from them. Most have been supportive of doing the aircraft detection and lighting systems on their facilities, but we don't have a lot of information from them in terms of the cost and some of the more details about those systems that I think are I would like to better understand. So looking forward to that and continue to push this to the next step.
Okay, and before we wrap up, I just want to wrap this up in this way. Up in my home country in Mercer County, the backside of my ranch touches against old abandoned spoil piles. And I'm always cautious. I don't want to criticize those people that did what they did 50 to 100 years ago because they needed heat, they needed electricity, they did not have the science, they did not have the large equipment, and they didn't have the technology to efficiently get the coal reserves that they needed and reclaim all that land. But once we figured it out, once we had the science, once we had the kinds of equipment it takes to do it, we built that requirement in, and there was a resistance to that at the time. But now when we look back, when we drive past reclaimed coal mine lands and see good quality farmland there, and then drive past the old, you know, pre-early 70s days of unreclaimed land, I think it just highlights the importance of doing this. Our generation cannot get so caught up in this spiral of federal subsidies and construction to just build, and not look out 20 or 30 years to what is going to be. I don't know, I haven't done the math, but I bet you we have 300,000 to 500,000 acres of North Dakota covered with wind turbines already. And we have got to make sure that someday these things come down, because just as you mining has changed, agriculture has changed, building construction has changed. I know we often hear, well, you know, they're just going to redo them as they wear out. But the fact of the matter is, just in these last dozen or so years that we've had industrial-sized wind farms in North Dakota, we've gone from 1 and 1.5 megawatt turbines to 2 to 3.5 megawatt turbines. They're going to continue to grow and expand, and then these foundations, I'm expecting in 20 or 30 years, will not be sufficient for what's new and modern at that time. We've got to make sure that we can get the countryside cleaned up and look ahead that much like people did 40 or 50 years ago when they started mine reclamation requirements.
Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
That concludes my portfolio. Commissioner Kalk.
Thank you, Rancher. Notice that's Chairman Rancher. Okay, let's get right to it. Item BK1. I move the Commission adopt the order on renewable resource cost recovery rates, Northern State Power Company's renewable cost recovery 2017 rates, case number PU16687.
Second.
Thank you, Julie. In November of last year, NSP filed an application for approval of its 2017 renewable resource cost recovery rider. In November of last year, we issued a notice of opportunity for hearing, and no one requested a hearing. We did talk about this, I believe, in an informal. The one thing about this, the renewable riders get filed every year by our investor-owned utilities. They're looking forward to the next year, what they think the costs are going to be. In this particular case, there were no new projects with this filing. Border Winds and Courtney Wind have been in Xcel's portfolio since the last time around. This case actually is a decrease of about 3 cents per month for the average customer using 750 kilowatts. So there used to be about 70 cents a month the average customer paid. Now it's going to go down to 67 cents a month. It may not sound like a lot, but every bit matters. And you roll this up, it's over $134,000 that the company will be requesting less revenue. And when you look at it, the reason it's less revenue this year is that the previous renewable rider included upfront costs from Border Winds, and those have kind of levelized over the last year or so. So certainly in order. I appreciate Xcel continuing to keep an eye on some of these wind costs, and it'll be very interesting, as Commissioner Crispin talked about, with some of the federal things going forward, how the future of wind farm developments lay out. But for these projects, you know, when Xcel came in front of us for the ADP, and I don't think the siting was different companies that got moved over to Xcel, they got a good deal on some of these wind farms, and so it's nice to see the costs are trending downward, and we'll see how that plays out in the future.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Since none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Thanks, Darrell. Item BK2. I move the commission suspend Otter Tail Company's rates and issues and issue a notice of opportunity for hearing in Otter Tail Power Company's 2017 Renewable Resource Cost Recovery Adjustment Factor, case number PU1716.
Second.
Thank you, Julie. Very similar to what we just did for Xcel. This is just in the front end of Otter Tail. They've requested that we look at their renewable rider for the next year. In this case, they're also proposing a decrease of about 49 cents from the average customer rate. And thanks to Sarah and the crack staff here, the customer was paying about $6.56, and they're going to be reduced to $6.07 for the next year. The difference for Otter Tail is Otter Tail has many more projects that are already in service. They have the Langdon Wind Farm, the Laverne Wind Farm, and the Ashtabula Wind Farm, and those have been built for many years, and they're in operation. So those costs have really stabilized. One of the things that when I saw that first, I was kind of taken back a little bit about why would the cost be decreasing this year, what they're asking for, when really these are mature projects. And some of the discussion we've had with Otter Tail on basically some of the federal tax policy, the tax depreciation, they were able to apply to their renewable riders. So that's why they're requesting the decrease in what they need for the riders. So it wasn't so much the cost of the projects went down. It was the tax benefits at the federal level, which benefited the company and this walk back to the customer. So we'll see if anybody wants a formal hearing on it, but that's kind of the setup for the case. Anyone that wants a hearing must request so by March 1st of 2017, and everything appears to be in order.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Thanks, Darrell. And last but not least for me, item BK3, I move the commission issue a notice of opportunity for hearing in Antelope Hills Wind Project LLC, West Branch Wind Project LLC, transfer of siting certificates and permit, siting application, case number PU16671.
Second.
Thank you, Julie. This is kind of what the case I was alluding to in our discussion about wind decommissioning rules. In this case, in December of 2014, the commission issued a certificate in site compatibility number 41 to Antelope Hills Wind Project, authorizing construction of up to 172 megawatts of wind farm in Mercer County. In January of that say of 15, the commission issued a certificate and corridor compatibility for approximately 9.5 miles of associated transmission. And what's happening in this case is the company of West Branch Wind would like to acquire the certificate from Antelope Hills. And so what we're doing today is anyone requesting a formal hearing must do so by February 28th, 2017. If someone requests a hearing, we could do it in an informal. And this is basically a company, Antelope Hills received the certificates. They have been unable to construct it. And so now they've got another company that wants to come in and acquire the certificate. So this is not the first time we've seen this, and it's always very interesting when you look back. When we've had those hearings, which all three of us participated in those hearings, you know, we asked the question, are you going to get this built? How is it going to go? Of course, we're going to get it built. Yeah, we're going to find a buyer. Well, here we are now a couple years later, and they haven't found a buyer, and they haven't got it built, and they're transferring it to someone else. And so this ties back to, I think, the rules package very clearly, just showing that if this thing does get built, to make sure that somebody is going to have to put together the right decommissioning plan and package, so if it does get built and somebody walks away, that there's the ability to clean it up. So certainly not prejudging this one way or the other, but I think the discussion will be very appropriate given the rules package and given that all three of us had that hearing. And like I said, this is not the first time we've seen this. But for today's plan of getting the notice issued for anyone requesting hearing, it certainly answers the mail.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
I will say, you know, that I hope that landowners are aware of and paying attention to these things when they transfer. You know, when we've had issues with pipeline, the existing pipelines over the 4+ years that I've been here, one of the most consistent complaints that we hear from landowners is one person comes and acquires the easement, but then when there's a problem, they're gone. We contact the company. That's changed. It's been sold or diverted off to someone else, and we can never find someone to talk to. Now, here's a case where the landowners that testified were generally favorable at the hearing. They in support of this. We approved it. But now it gets shifted to a different company. And do those landowners still want this construction from this new company? Because it's not the same company. It's not the same landman. So I hope they're paying attention and will voice their opinion on it.
That's a good point, Randy. And I think it's important to note that that's the part of our review, is that we're looking at those very things, is whether the company can and is committed to following the same permit requirements that were issued to the company that we provided the permit to. And so that's what we review in the transfer process, and whether they agree to abide by the same permit conditions and whether they have the ability to abide by those same financial or same conditions. So it's an important review and one that we don't take lightly. And so I look forward to either doing that in an informal hearing if we choose, or having a more formal process for having that review and the public input that comes with it.
Is there any further discussion? Since none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, motion is approved.
That concludes my portfolio, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Fedorchak.
All righty. I have one item on the agenda today. I move the Commission adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law and order in Epping Transmission Company, LLC, 12.75-inch crude oil pipeline, Williams County, citing application case number PU-16-614.
Second.
Thank you, Brian. This is a pipeline that is 3.2 miles, relatively short, 12-inch diameter steel crude oil pipeline with a main line. That's the main line, and then 2 8-inch diameter steel connector crude oil pipelines, each approximately 0.1 miles in length, and then some associated facilities all located near the city of Williams County. We did go out to Williams County for this hearing and had a good conversation with the company, and didn't have any members of the public express concerns about this at that time during our hearing. The connectors will transport crude oil between the mainline and Metalark Midstream Company's LLC divide lateral line, and between the mainline and Dakota Access LLC valve site located on the north side of the Crestwood Colt rail hub. The maximum capacity of the mainline will be 70,000 barrels per day, with expected initial capacity of 30,000 barrels per day. And then of the connectors, the maximum capacity will be 50,000 barrels per day, with the expected initial capacity of 20,000 barrels per day. The total anticipated cost of the project is $7 million. In terms of the review of the permit requirements, the North Dakota SHPO concurred with the no significant sites affected recommendation for the project. There are three cultural resources present in the survey area. One was determined not to be eligible for listing in the National Register of Historic Places. The remaining two cultural resources are unevaluated for that listing, and they will be avoided with a 50-foot construction buffer zone around each of those resources. There weren't any other exclusion areas in the survey area. There, in terms of avoidance areas, there's 8 rural residences located within 500 feet of the pipeline. And the company received and obtained waivers from all of those residences, and they are filed with our office, and there weren't any other avoidance areas present in the survey area. Epping testified that they developed an emergency response plan, and they have filed a copy of that plan in our office. They have will testify that they will have a supervisory control and data acquisition system installed as part of the project. It will monitor pressure, temperature, and flow continuously at a control center in Woodlands, Texas. We had an extensive conversation with them about their control center and how it's monitored and maintained. They testified that the project will be designed, constructed, and operated in accordance with the federal regulations required for it. And they testified that they will be X-raying 100% of its pipeline welds, and also testified on a number of other reclamation-related items, such as they're going to consult with landowners on reseeding, they're going to provide temporary fencing for livestock during reseeding, they're going to take some extra precautions regarding weeds and weed contamination. And then the biggest issue that we talked about on this project was winter construction. The company asked to have us waive our requirements that they not do any construction after the topsoil has frozen to the point that the frost inhibits proper soil segregation. And we talked to them extensively, and they have agreed to a number of requirements on that regards, including that they will follow the guidelines for successful reclamation of lands disturbed by oil and gas development and infrastructure construction put out by NDSU, and in particular the winter construction guidelines in that document and several other industry standards for winter construction. And so with that in place and their agreement on that and their understanding that we are concerned about this and we'll be watching closely how it's done, I think it's appropriate for this a line of this length, which is relatively short, to waive that requirement in our standards. So that said, I think this is a pipeline that provides some operational flexibility for the company between a variety of different export pipelines and other transport options, including the Colt rail hub. And so it will facilitate additional trucks off the road and improved safety in that area and the most efficient transport of this product. And I think everything is ordered to support this permit.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
I just comment on the winter construction. I think that's absolutely the right thing to do in this case. I think sometimes winter construction is the best time to build these pipelines. You're not worried about the species issues, and you can get it done and have a good follow-through. So I think it's a good idea, and thanks for putting it together.
Agreed. Now, I would just point out, for such a short pipeline, as I don't remember exact, just a few miles, they had it's quite a kind of a threading of the needle to loop around Epping there and deal with the residents you mentioned and the cultural resources. There's a railroad that they have to go by, a highway. And so it's a kind of a tough project, but all the evidence at the hearing seemed to indicate that they're up for it and prepared for it, and I think it's a good project.
Is there any further discussion?
Make sure they call before you dig. It's their biggest reason pipelines fail.
Any further discussion? Since none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Concludes my portfolio.
Okay. We'll stand in recess for questions from the press, and then we'll reconvene for announcements and other business.
All right. Just so we're clear, what will landowners expect from the new rules on the wind farms? If you can give that a real quick nutshell about for landowners, what is the benefit to them?
I think upon full adoption, the benefit that they're going to have is, one, starting with new wind farms that are impacted by it, there will be financial assurances put in place before commencement of construction. So if something happens to a facility after 5 or 6 or 7 years, they're not just left hanging out there with nothing. So it's initial implementation of the financial assurances requirement. The financial assurance are going to be stronger. It's going to require the foundations and those types of things to be removed down to 4 feet instead of 3. And I guess as a real nutshell assessment, I would probably stop there.
What is the – do we have any data about what – is the life of a wind farm?
We've had testimony where they talk about 20 to 25 or 25 to 30, I think, is what we most commonly hear in cases. But, you know, this has been such a quick evolution of the industry and of the technology they use. Really, when we're talking about building a wind farm now, the current siting cases, the equipment and technology they're using is really a lot different than what the initial ones were 10 or 12 years ago. And so those haven't even reached end of useful life. So I don't really know how we know. It really is an estimate that I wouldn't have anything to base it on in my mind other than what they tell us in the hearings are there.
In some of our initial conversations with the companies after the 10-year period, we had some informal hearings with some of the earliest commercial-scale wind farm producers in North Dakota, and asked, what experience do you have on decommissioning a utility-scale wind farm? And they really didn't have any. So there isn't one that you can point to that's been completed nationally, at least not any that any of the companies that operate in North Dakota have experience with. So we really are trying our best to anticipate what the issues are going to be and provide rules that account for those and make sure that the financial assurances are in place, that there's enough money to do the job when it comes time to do it.
Dave, if I could, I think that what I look at it is I would really want to encourage the companies to have a depreciation schedule that has them depreciated out at 20 years. Because I think we're going to get 20 years out of these wind farms. And then if at 20 years it's depreciated out and it still works under 15 years, it's money in the bank for everyone. And so when the big thing when they put together their schedule, get those monies in place so when the customers really benefit is towards that last few years. And that's where, let's say year 28, you maybe have to put some O&M dollars into it. It's paid for. So then I think that the hubs themselves or the towers and the base, I think they'd be like a pipeline. You could probably get 50 years out of them. It's the inners, I think, that you may have to replace. And if they depreciate them out in 20 years, then it comes time to refit them, it'll still be profitable.
I think one of the factors you'll see, whatever that time frame is, just like there are a lot of coal and gas and nuclear plants right now that could go longer if someone chose to keep them going. But they're not. When you get out 20 or 30 years on these, if there are subsidies that tip the market upside down to the point where it's more economical to take the subsidies and build something new and abandon the old, then it doesn't really matter how long they could have lasted. It will matter what's the most financially sound decision at the time. So
it's really an effort to hope for the best but plan for the worst. And really trying to recognize, you know, there's been a lot of conversation with the companies really want to be able to rely on the salvage value. And I think there's a role for a salvage value. But can you count on the salvage value entirely for the financial assurances? Probably not. So what's needed in addition to the salvage value? And then, you know, Commissioner Christman brings a point up that he doesn't really like counting on the salvage value at all because nobody knows you can't anticipate it 20, 30 years from now. That's the type of conversation we've been having, and it's been really valuable. And I think that, you know, in the end we'll find the proper balance that recognizes the risk that the industry is and provides a good, stable platform for protecting the landscape long term.
Do you know offhand what the oldest wind farm in North Dakota is?
It's the Woolley and Wally up there in Minot. They're like 12 years, Jerry, is that?
Or is it the Richardson Abbey?
Well, that might be. Those weren't sited, probably.
Yeah, those would be unsited.
Well, but they're wind.
I think about the one near Valley City.
I think that maybe is the first one. And
I think the Valley City ones, and there was one in Petersburg.
Yeah, on Highway 2. But those were not sited by the commission at that time.
Yeah, and these are large turbines. They're bigger than that nowadays. After that, there was, I think, some stuff down in the Ellendale area.
I'm just curious.
Is the one at Valley City operational? Because
yeah.
It wasn't turning on Saturday, but the snow was drifting, so there was wind.
But Dave, it was 2 years ago, or maybe 3 years ago, was the first time that we had to have the financial assurances discussion. because the law, the rules were such that the commission may require financial assurances. So I remember that's when the two turbines up in Minot came in is the first I remember, and then there was some of the NextEra wind farms that came in about the financial assurances when I think the three of us really started that discussion, because my previous colleagues not interested in that discussion, and the rules were such they didn't have to have the discussion. So I think that was kind of the beginning of where we ended up at today.
Do you have anything? Go
ahead. On the Epping transmission, do you have any information about when they're going to start construction?
You know what? They weren't real clear. It was somewhat pending on Dakota Access, I believe. And so I don't think they were going to continue or move forward with construction until there was some certainty on Dakota Access completion. Well, just yesterday, the president initiated this requirement for an EIS, and I think at this point, it's there's too much in the air, up in the air to guess. I don't understand the rules that apply to the administrative agencies. Once one decree has been made, can another president come in and make a different decree that completely undermines that last decree, or is there some obligation to follow what was said? That is a whole body of administrative laws and rules that I don't think we understand here yet to be able to say what the next steps are going to be and when.
Amy, I'd like to comment on that if that's all right. So another life, when I was environmental compliance guy at the Marine Base at Camp Pendleton, did probably 200 NEPA projects. And so NEPA says you can do a CADEX, categorically exclude something, an EA, environmental assessment, that says you can go through the review and there's no harm done, which was done for this crossing. They basically said that that's what the agency that came up with, that's what the federal judge affirmed, that the EA was done properly. And, of course, you got the EIS, which means you go through it, and basically it determines there will be some harm, but then you have to mitigate that harm. And so what the president has done is completely out of the realm of what the law of NEPA says you can do. So I think that there'll be court action that's going to basically say the president does not have jurisdiction to call an EIS because the agency that has the jurisdiction makes the determination. They went through the study. They determined an EA was fine. That has been challenged. So what's going on now? This is rhetoric. And to say that an EIS would ever stop, let's say you went to an EIS, to say it would ever stop a project, that's not the case. We went through many full-blown EISs at Camp Pendleton, and at the end there was impact to the Tidewater Gobi or something like that. Well, then you'd have to mitigate it somewhere else. Just like when Vrendre Electric and Basin built that wind farm, the one south of Minot, they did a full-blown EIS, and they determined that they needed to offset something, so they bought some other land somewhere else as a mitigation factor. So this is just all rhetoric. At the end of the day, the environmental review has taken place, and it's all going to, I think, work itself out, because I think the courts will quickly look at this and say you cannot do an EIS, demand it, when an EA has already been walked through and the courts have already upheld that. That's my viewpoint as BP Culp. With extensive experience in NEPA. This is the federal actions. We had this stuff challenged all the time. And if you can show that the NEPA process was followed, which they did, it holds. And so the EIS, I think, is just one more way to keep those that are against the Dakota Access Pipeline stirred up and have them do things like they've been doing out there, and it's just time for it to stop.
I think that I totally agree with all of that. The question is, everything you said has already, that's, none of that is new fact, yet we're still held up. So how does that change?
Well, I think the EIS, there'll be a challenge that EIS doesn't have the authority to do that. So, yes, there'll be a protracted, more legal discussion. But
yeah. Or can President Trump come and provide a different edict? Or does he have to follow the EIS?
I think he would. I think in that
That's
case,
the
agency
would.
Well, exactly.
Answered. You know, like, can he just nullify that and say, now I grant this? And that's where I'd really like to have some clarity. Because the courts, obviously, whatever happens, it's going to be one of the parties will take it to court and it'll be tangled up there.
It looks like the courts are going to be busy for a while.
Yeah.
Well, but the point I wanted to get out is the people talk about this NEPA process as a way that, I don't know, stop projects. It never is intended that way. It's designed to know the outcome and then you mitigate it. So at the end of the day, whether it would be an EA or an EIS, if that would come to prove, the EAIS would lean heavily on the EA. And unless they saw something different, it would end up with the same outcome. And even if there was a different outcome, they would just have to mitigate it somewhere else, and it would be built. So, I mean, there is a path forward for the Dakota Access Pipeline. They just have to stay committed, and so does those doing the law enforcement with those that, out there that are causing harm.
One other thing. On the consent agenda, CBK5, you have a case with an 07 number.
Ah, yes.
And it's Northern States Power Company.
Those buggers at NSP again. What are they up to, Dave?
I'm just curious, 10 years, you know, almost 10 years?
Sure. What that is the company filed, that was the rate case that we had.
Yeah.
And basically we said you come in front of us for an ADP for everything. And they filed a couple motions. One, they wanted to get a waiver for coming in front of us for transmission. And the other was for basically to set the waiver parameters. What this was does today is basically they've requested to withdraw the transmission part of it. And we've got a work session next Monday that's going to talk about the waiver procedures. And if we would approve that, they could request waivers for anything. If we don't approve it, then so be it. But they filed both of these. Once we had the initial discussion with the company, we offered up and they agreed that pulling this one back would make it a little cleaner. We can just have the discussion. So it's back to that 07 rate case.
And just one more thing. It's next week that the public hearing is for MDU?
Monday and Wednesday.
Monday and Wednesday.
Two public input sessions. I wouldn't say public hearings.
The hearing is in April.
Yeah, public input sessions. Do you expect crowds this time?
I have not heard the angst that I've heard on other cases, and I don't know if it's just because people are busy, but typically by now you get a lot of calls of something. I don't know. Stacy, I haven't seen...
Anything. There aren't any official interveners.
No.
Which always, I like it when outsiders intervene because it brings more parties to the table and has more people looking at it, and I just find that beneficial. But nobody has intervened yet, so that suggests that, you know, there aren't any large obvious groups that are concerned. ARP or any industrial users or some of those that have expressed some concerns in the past.
I will say, though, as an AARP member, I've received some emails.
Oh, have you?
Yeah. Just saying that these are coming up if you're interested.
Okay.
Not taking a position one way or the other, just saying that these are coming up.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just kind of curious.
I will point out on that subject before I'm going to touch on those, give the times and stuff in the announcements. And I don't recall that we have done this in previous public input sessions on rate cases, and I think this came from Commissioner Fedorchuk, but we have an email out there, vshook@nd.gov, that will be available during the public input session. So while the input sessions are going to be interconnected between Williston, Dickinson, and here, in both instances, one in the evening, one in the morning, people who don't want to travel to them but have a question will be able to email us at that email address and get their questions in. So maybe that will add additional input.
Can't take credit for that idea, though. It was either Stacy or Victor or one of our staff. It is a good one.
We have a crack staff, and it is a good thing. And any other questions? Okay, then we'll reconvene. And for announcements, tomorrow, we have an ALJ doing a formal hearing up in Williston at the Ernie French Center at the NDSU Research Extension Center on the Savage Bakken Connector Pipeline. That's case number PU-16-753. Monday and Wednesday are those public input sessions on the MDU rate case. Monday, it will be at 7:30 p.m., and the three locations are here in our hearing room on the 12th floor of the Capitol, in Williston at the Ernie French Center that I mentioned, in Dickinson in the Kleinfelter Room 216. And again, that's 7:30 p.m. Central Time. So for those Dickinson folks or anyone else in the Mountain Time Zone, 6 o'clock. Then on Wednesday, we'll do it during the daytime. We'll have it at noon. Same locations, except for out in Dickinson. It's in the Kleinfelter Auditorium that day, and that one will be at 12 o'clock Central Time, 11 o'clock Mountain Time. And again, vshuck, V as in Victor, S-C-H-O-C-K, at nd.gov if someone wants to email a question in. And if they want to contact us, they can watch and listen to the sessions interactively. But there's a password, and I don't have all that stuff, but they should call the office, and we can get them that information. I'm sure it's on our website.
It's right on the main page of the website. So they go to our main page and call right there.
So to get that on the broadcast, go to the main page of our website, and it's on the front page there, the sign-in information. And that's all the announcements that I have.
Mr. Chair. Oh. I want to highlight that MISO SPP discussion next Tuesday as well. We seldom get the RTOs up here. And since last year wasn't the year of the transmission, maybe this year will be the year of the transmission line. So anybody that wants to listen to that robust discussion.
I thought every year was the year of transmission, except for on the years of Call Before You Dig.
It's like the Olympics. It moves around.
4 years.
Okay, so we will take a 10-minute break, and then we'll be reconvening for the administration of the portion of the meeting. This meeting is adjourned.